Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. You know, we love getting into the nitty-gritty of these ancient texts, and today we're diving into some really fascinating stuff with Isaiah.
Oh yeah, Isaiah just packed these powerful images and thought-provoking prophecies.
You can say that again. We're zeroing in on chapters 14 through 16, where Isaiah shifts his focus to the nations surrounding Judah.
It's like he zooms out from the internal struggles of Israel and Judah to give us this bigger picture of what's happening in the region.
Exactly. And it's not just a history lesson. Isaiah uses these interactions with other nations to explore some really timeless themes about power trust and where we ultimately place our hope.
And I think that's what makes these chapters so relevant for us today. I mean, look at the world around us. We're still grappling with those same questions about who to trust, where to find security in a world that feels increasingly uncertain.
Okay, so before we get ahead of ourselves, let's lay the groundwork. What's the historical context here? What's going on in Judah and the surrounding region during Isaiah's time?
So we're talking about the 8th century BC, and Judah is this small nation sandwiched between some really powerful empires, Assyria to the north, Egypt to the south, and then you've got these smaller kingdoms like Philistia and Moab constantly vying for power.
So it's a bit of a political pressure cooker.
Hmm.
And where does Isaiah fit into all of this?
Isaiah was a prophet called by God to speak truth to power. He wasn't afraid to challenge the kings, the priests, the people, to turn back to God and to live in accordance with his covenant.
So he was kind of like the conscience of the nation, calling them out on their hypocrisy and their misplaced trust for things that couldn't ultimately save them.
Yeah, and he didn't sugarcoat things either. He delivered some pretty harsh warnings about the consequences of turning away from God, but he also offered this incredible message of hope and restoration.
It's that balance, right? Yeah. The judgment and the mercy. It's a thread that runs through the entire prophetic tradition.
Absolutely. And in chapters 14 through 16, we see that same dynamic at play. Isaiah pronounces judgment on the surrounding nations, but it's not out of spite or vengeance. It's more like a surgeon removing a tumor to try to save the patient.
That's a powerful image.
Yeah.
So what's the central message that Isaiah is trying to convey to these nations?
I think the core message is this. Don't put your trust in human power or political alliances because they're ultimately unreliable and fleeting. True security and lasting hope can only be found in God.
It's a message that echoes throughout the Bible, isn't it? That human attempts to create utopia or achieve lasting peace apart from God are destined to fail.
Yes, and Isaiah uses these historical examples to illustrate that point. He starts with Babylon, but not the literal city of Babylon as it existed in his time.
So he's using Babylon as a symbol.
Exactly. He's using Babylon to represent this broader concept of human pride and ambition that seeks to rival God. It's about that desire to build towers, to make a name for ourselves, to become like God.
I see. And that idea of Babylon as a symbol of human arrogance pops up again later in the Bible, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Big time. In the book of Revelation, Babylon takes on this even more profound symbolic meaning, potentially representing Rome, the dominant empire of John's time.
So even centuries later, that image of Babylon as this embodiment of human rebellion against God, it still held this incredible power.
Absolutely. It speaks to the enduring relevance of Isaiah's message and how it transcends time and culture.
You know, it's fascinating to think that in John's day, Babylon was just a small village. It wasn't this thriving metropolis anymore, but it still carried this symbolic weight.
Yeah, it shows you how these symbols can become so ingrained in our collective consciousness that they can evoke these powerful emotions and ideas even centuries after their original context has faded away.
It's like the ruins of a once great empire serving as a warning sign to future generations. Don't go down this path. Don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
And that's exactly the point Isaiah is making. He's using Babylon as this cautionary tale, this reminder that human power is fleeting and that those who exalt themselves will ultimately be humbled.
It's a theme that resonates throughout history, right? From the rise and fall of empires to the stories of individual leaders who let power corrupt them.
It's a timeless human struggle, that desire for control, that pursuit of glory that ultimately leads to destruction. But Isaiah is offering an alternative. He's saying there's a better way, a more secure foundation, a path to true lasting peace.
And that path is?
Trusting in God, aligning ourselves with his will, seeking his guidance, rather than relying on our own limited understanding and strength.
It's a radical proposition, isn't it?
Yeah.
To let go of that need for control, to surrender to a power that's greater than ourselves.
Yeah, but it's also incredibly liberating. Because when we let go of that burden of trying to control everything, when we acknowledge our limitations and embrace our dependence on God, well, that's when we experience true freedom.
So it's not about passivity or resignation. It's about a different kind of strength, a strength that comes from humility, from recognizing that we're not the center of the universe.
Exactly. It's about acknowledging that we're part of something much bigger than ourselves and that we're invited to participate in God's redemptive work in the world. But that participation requires trust. It requires surrender.
Okay, so we've got Babylon as this overarching symbol of human pride and misplaced trust.
Mm-hmm.
But Isaiah gets even more specific, right? He zooms in on the nations surrounding Judah and delivers these pointed messages to each of them.
Oh, yeah. He calls them out by name, and he doesn't hold back. He addresses their specific sins, their arrogance, their idolatry, their oppression of the weak, and he warns them of the consequences of their actions.
So let's start with Assyria. They were the dominant power in the region at that time, kind of like the superpower of the ancient Near East.
Exactly. They were known for their military might, their ruthlessness, their expansionist policies. They were a force to be reckoned with, and they posed a serious threat to Judah.
So what does Isaiah have to say about them?
Well, Isaiah acknowledges Assyria's power, but he also makes it clear that they're not ultimately in control. He uses the image of God's hand to describe how he's using Assyria as an instrument of judgment.
So it's not that God is endorsing Assyria's brutality or condoning their actions, but he's working within the larger narrative of history, using even their evil for his purposes.
Exactly. Isaiah is emphasizing God's sovereignty, his control over the nations, his ability to work out his plans, even through the actions of wicked rulers.
It's a reminder that even when things look bleak, even when evil seems to be winning, there's a bigger picture at play. God is still on the throne, and he's ultimately working towards his purposes.
And we see this idea really hammered home in Isaiah 14:24-27, where the words purposed and planned are repeated over and over. It's like God is saying, don't be fooled by appearances. I'm the one calling the shots. I'm the one orchestrating events.
Okay, but that can be a tough concept to grasp, right? Because if God is in control, why does he allow so much suffering? Why does he allow evil to flourish?
That's the age-old question, isn't it? And there's no easy answer. But I think Isaiah is pointing us towards a perspective of faith, a trust in God's wisdom and goodness, even when we don't understand his ways.
It's like that saying, God's ways are not our ways.
Yeah.
Sometimes his purposes are hidden from us, but we can trust that he's working all things together for good.
And we see that trust played out in a dramatic way in the story of the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah. That's a pivotal moment in Judah's history. It's like a showdown between human power and divine intervention.
Absolutely. You've got the Assyrian army surrounding Jerusalem, seemingly invincible on the verge of conquering the city. It looks like all hope is lost.
And this is after King Ahaz had tried to make an alliance with Assyria for protection.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Which just goes to show that putting your trust in human alliances can backfire spectacularly.
But then God steps in.
Yeah, in a big way. An angel of the Lord strikes down 185,000 Assyrian soldiers overnight. It's this stunning display of God's power over seemingly invincible forces.
Talk about a game changer. It's like God saying, look, I'm still in control. Don't underestimate my power to deliver those who trust in me.
And Isaiah uses that powerful image of God's outstretched hand, this hand that can both judge and deliver. It's a reminder that God is both just and merciful, that he opposes those who oppose him, but he also extends grace and protection to those who seek him.
That image really captures the tension that runs throughout Isaiah's message. It's not just about judgment or just about mercy. It's about both.
Exactly. It's about holding those two seemingly opposite ideas together, recognizing that God is both righteous and compassionate, both powerful and loving.
Okay, so we've talked about Babylon as a symbol of human pride and Assyria as this instrument of God's judgment. What about some of the other nations that Isaiah addresses?
Well, he turns his attention to Philistia next, a nation that had a long and contentious history with Judah.
Ah, yes, the Philistines. Those guys were always a thorn in Judah's side. Weren't they constantly battling for control of that strip of land along the Mediterranean coast?
You got it. They were rivals for territory, for resources, for power. And in Isaiah 14:28-32, we see the Philistines rejoicing at the death of King Ahaz.
They saw it as an opportunity to pounce on a weakened Judah, right?
Exactly. They're celebrating, thinking they've got the upper hand. But Isaiah delivers a sobering prophecy.
What does he say?
He basically tells them, don't get too cocky. Your celebration is short-lived because I'm about to bring famine, destruction, and death upon you.
It's like a cosmic reality check. Isaiah is saying, you're putting your trust in a fleeting moment of perceived advantage, but you're forgetting who's really in control.
Exactly. And in contrast to this bleak outlook for Philistia, Isaiah promises refuge for Judah in Zion, emphasizing God's faithfulness to his people.
So it's this stark contrast, right? Philistia placing their trust in military strength and opportunistic alliances, facing a grim future, while Judah, despite his weaknesses, finds security in God's protection.
And that contrast really highlights the central message of these chapters. Don't put your trust in unreliable human alliances or fleeting moments of power. True security can only be found in God's enduring promises.
It's a message that's so relevant for us today, isn't it? In a world where we're constantly bombarded with messages about who to trust, what to believe, where to find security,
it's more important than ever to discern the voices that are leading us towards truth, towards lasting hope, towards a foundation that won't crumble under pressure.
So Isaiah is challenging us to take a step back, to evaluate our priorities, to ask ourselves, where am I placing my trust? Is it in things that are ultimately fleeting and unreliable? Or am I building my life on the solid rock of God's love and faithfulness?
That's the question we all have to wrestle with. And I think the answers can be found not only in the grand pronouncements of prophets, but also in the quiet whispers of our own hearts as we seek God's guidance and discern his will for our lives.
It's a journey of faith, isn't it? A constant process of learning to trust God more deeply and surrender to his purposes more fully.
It's a lifelong adventure, and it's one that's filled with both challenges and rewards. But ultimately, it leads us to a place of true security and lasting peace, a peace that the world can't give and the world can't take away.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. We've talked about Babylon, Assyria, Philistia, and that central message of trusting God, not nations. But Isaiah doesn't stop there. He goes on to address another nation with a complex relationship with Judah, Moab.
And the story of Moab is a fascinating one. It's a tale of lament, grief, and misplaced hope. It's a story that speaks to the fragility of human power and the enduring compassion of God.
I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, Moab was a nation that had a history of both conflict and cooperation with Judah. They were sometimes enemies, sometimes allies, but always wary of each other.
And it was a complicated relationship, like a family feud that spanned generations.
Exactly. And in chapters 15 and 16 of Isaiah, we see this relationship come to a head as Moab faces devastation and displacement at the hands of the Assyrians.
So they're caught in the crossfire of this power struggle between the bigger empires.
Exactly. And the tone of these chapters is one of deep lament. It's like a funeral dirge, this poignant portrayal of a nation facing utter ruin.
It's a reminder that even nations that seem strong and stable can experience sudden and dramatic upheaval. It makes you think about the refugees we see in our own time, fleeing war persecution, natural disasters.
It's a timeless human story, isn't it? The fragility of life, the precarious nature of security, the way that circumstances can change in an instant.
And in the midst of this upheaval, what do the Moabites do?
They turn to Judah for help. They appeal for refuge, for protection from the very people they'd once considered rivals.
It's a bit ironic, isn't it? Today's enemy becomes tomorrow's refugee.
Yeah, it highlights the precarious nature of trusting in nations for security. It's a reminder that political alliances are fickle, that power dynamics can shift in an instant, and that ultimately true security can only be found in something more enduring, something more transcendent.
So what does Judah's response to Moab's plea tell us about the nature of true leadership?
That's where things get really interesting, because in Isaiah 16.5, we get this glimpse of an ideal king, a king whose throne is established not in military might or political maneuvering, but in chesed and mishpat.
Now, those are two powerful Hebrew concepts that we've touched on before, but I think they're worth unpacking a bit more because they really get to the heart of what Isaiah is trying to convey.
Absolutely. Chesed is often translated as loving kindness or steadfast love. But it's so much richer than that. It's a love that's rooted in covenant faithfulness, a love that's unwavering, even in the face of adversity.
So it's not just about warm, fuzzy feelings. It's about a deeper commitment, a loyalty that runs much deeper than fleeting emotions.
Exactly. It's the kind of love that God has for his people, and it's the kind of love that he calls us to reflect in our own lives.
It's about putting love into action through faithfulness. Through a willingness to go the extra mile to care for others, even when it's difficult, even when it costs us something.
And then there's mishpat, which is often translated as justice, but it also encompasses this idea of right living, of aligning our actions with God's will.
So it's about creating a society that reflects God's heart for fairness, for equity, for righteousness.
Exactly. And notice that this ideal king's throne isn't established in a grand palace, but in the tent of David.
Now, what's the significance of that?
It's a reminder that true leadership isn't about outward displays of power or material grandeur. It's about humility, about recognizing that authority ultimately comes from God, and it's about serving others rather than seeking self-promotion.
This is a powerful image, and it definitely challenges our modern notions of leadership, which often seem to prioritize charisma dominance and the pursuit of personal gain.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, are we looking for leaders who embody these qualities of Chesed and Mishpat, or are we settling for those who prioritize their own interests above the well-being of others?
It's a question we all need to grapple with, both in terms of the leaders we choose to follow and the kind of leadership we embody in our own lives.
Absolutely. Because true leadership isn't limited to those in positions of authority. It's about how we live our lives, how we treat others, how we use our influence, whether big or small.
So it's about embodying those principles of Chesed and Mishpat in our everyday interactions, in our families, our communities, our workplaces.
It's about making choices that reflect God's love and justice, even in the smallest of things.
Okay, I'm starting to see how these pieces fit together.
Yeah.
Isaiah is challenging us to reevaluate our priorities, to let go of our misplaced trust in things that can't ultimately satisfy, and to embrace a radical dependence on God that leads to true freedom and fulfillment.
It's a message that's as relevant today as it was in Isaiah's time. And it's a message that has the power to transform not only our own lives, but also the world around us.
This has been an incredible deep dive. It's amazing how much we've unpacked from just a few chapters of Isaiah. And I have a feeling we've only just scratched the surface.
There's so much more to explore here. But I think we've laid a good foundation for understanding the core message of these chapters and how they speak to us today.
Absolutely. So to our listeners out there, I hope this deep dive has inspired you to keep digging deeper, to keep wrestling with these big questions about where you place your trust and how you live out your faith in a world that desperately needs to see God's love and justice in action.
And remember, you're not alone in this journey. We're all in this together, seeking to follow God's leading and to make a difference in the world.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time to take a break and let these ideas simmer for a bit. We'll be back soon to continue our exploration of Isaiah and to delve even deeper into these themes of trust, surrender, and the power of God's love and justice.
Looking forward to it. See you next time. See you then.
Picking up where we left off last time, we were talking about how Isaiah paints this really vivid picture of Moab's downfall.
It's heartbreaking, really. The way he describes their lament, their grief over the destruction of their land, their cities, their way of life.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he doesn't shy away from the emotional impact of this devastation. He uses this really poetic language to convey their sense of loss and despair.
Exactly. It's not just a dry historical account. It's an invitation to empathize, to feel the weight of what's happening to these people.
It's like he's saying, look, this is what happens when you put your trust in the wrong things, when you rely on your own strength, your own resources, your own gods.
And I think that's a message that's so relevant for us today. I mean, how often do we find ourselves clinging to things that can't ultimately satisfy us, whether it's money, power, possessions, or even just our own sense of self-sufficiency?
Yeah, it's so easy to get caught up in those things, to believe that they'll bring us security or happiness.
Yeah.
But Isaiah is reminding us that true security, true joy, true fulfillment can only be found in God.
And that's why the story of Moab is so tragic, because they had this opportunity to turn to God, to seek his protection, to find refuge in him. But they chose to rely on their own strength, their own ingenuity, and it ultimately led to their downfall.
But it's not like God just abandoned them, right? He still extended his compassion, even in the midst of their rebellion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at the language Isaiah uses. He describes God as being moved with compassion for Moab. He grieves over their suffering. He longs for their restoration.
So it's not that God takes pleasure in their destruction. He disciplines those he loves, but his heart is always for their redemption.
Exactly. And I think that's such an important message for us to remember, because we all mess up. We all stray from God's path. We all make choices that lead to pain and brokenness. But God's love for us never changes.
His mercy is always available to us, if we're willing to turn to him to confess our sins, to seek his forgiveness.
And that's the beauty of the gospel message. It's not about earning God's favor. It's about receiving his grace. It's about recognizing that we can't save ourselves, but he can.
And that brings us back to that central question of trust, right?
Yep.
If we're not supposed to trust in nations or human systems, then where do we place our hope?
Well, Isaiah gives us a clue in chapter 16, verse 5. Remember that description of the ideal king, the one whose throne is established in Chesed and Mishpat?
Yeah, those two powerful Hebrew concepts that we unpacked earlier.
Yeah.
It's like they're the foundation of true leadership. the blueprint for a society that reflects God's heart.
Exactly. And I think they're also the keys to understanding where we find true security and lasting hope. It's not in political power or military might. It's in embodying those principles of hesed and mishpat in our own lives.
So it's about more than just talking about God's love and justice. It's about living them out in our everyday interactions and the way we treat others in the choices we make.
Absolutely. It's about letting those principles shape our priorities, our relationships, our work, our engagement with the world around us.
It's about being a reflection of God's character in a world that desperately needs to see his love and justice in action.
And I think that's where we find true meaning and purpose. It's not in chasing after fleeting things, but in aligning ourselves with God's will and letting his love flow through us.
It's a radical proposition, isn't it?
Yeah.
To live in a way that prioritizes love and justice above all else.
Yeah, it goes against the grain of our culture, which often tells us to look out for, number one, to prioritize our own success, our own comfort, our own security.
But Isaiah is calling us to something different, something higher, something more enduring. He's calling us to live in a way that reflects the heart of God.
And that's a challenge worth embracing. It's a journey worth taking. It's a life worth living.
You know, one thing that's been striking me throughout this conversation is how Isaiah doesn't just pronounce judgment on these nations. He also grieves over their suffering. He longs for their redemption.
It's like he's holding these two seemingly opposite emotions together, this sense of righteous anger at their sin and this deep compassion for their brokenness.
It's a reminder that God's heart is always for restoration. He desires wholeness for all of creation.
And even though he disciplines those he loves, his ultimate goal is to bring them back to himself, to heal their wounds, to restore their relationship with him.
So it's not just about punishment. It's about redemption. It's about offering a path back to life, back to hope, back to wholeness.
Exactly. And I think that's where we see the true power of God's love. It's a love that's willing to confront sin, to expose darkness. But it's also a love that's always seeking to redeem, to restore, to make things new.
And that's a message that gives me hope. It reminds me that even when things seem hopeless, even when the world feels broken beyond repair, God is still at work.
He's still weaving his tapestry of redemption. He's still drawing people to himself. He's still offering forgiveness and healing and new life.
And that's a message that I think we all need to hear, especially in these times where it's easy to get discouraged, to lose sight of the bigger picture, to feel overwhelmed by the darkness around us.
Absolutely. But Isaiah reminds us that God is bigger than our circumstances. He's bigger than our fears. He's bigger than our doubts.
He's the God who sees the end from the beginning, the God who holds all things in his hands, the God who is making all things new.
And that's a truth that can anchor us, a hope that can sustain us, a love that can transform us.
This has been such a powerful conversation. I feel like we've only just scratched the surface of what Isaiah has to teach us about trust, surrender, and the power of God's love and justice.
And that's the beauty of God's word, isn't it? It's a well that never runs dry, a source of wisdom and inspiration that we can keep coming back to again and again.
And I think that's a great place to pause for now. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I always love to leave our listeners with something to chew on, something to ponder, something to spark further exploration on their own.
So here's a question to consider. As we've been talking about trusting God, not nations, it's made me think about the different ways we place our trust in things other than God.
Yeah, like what are those useless gods that we tend to cling to in our own lives? What are those things that promise security or satisfaction, but ultimately leave us empty and disillusioned?
I think it's different for everyone, but it might be our careers, our possessions, our social status, our relationships, even our own intellect or abilities.
It's anything that we allow to take God's place in our lives. Anything that we rely on for our sense of worth or purpose or security.
And the challenge is to identify those useless gods in our own lives and to begin to dismantle the altars we've built to them.
It's a process of surrender, of letting go of our need for control and trusting that God has something better for us.
It's a journey of faith, a journey of discovering the freedom that comes from placing our trust in the one who is truly worthy of it.
I love that. So to our listeners out there, I encourage you to take some time this week to reflect on that question. What are those useless gods that you might be clinging to? And what would it look like to start surrendering them to God and embracing the freedom that comes from trusting in him alone?
It's a challenge worth embracing, a journey worth taking, a life worth living.
Amen to that. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll be back next time to wrap up our exploration of Isaiah and to delve even deeper into these themes of trust, surrender, and the power of God's love and justice.
Can't wait. See you then.
Okay, so we're back and ready to wrap up our deep dive into Isaiah chapters 14 through 16. You know, I always love these conversations because they really challenge me to think differently about how I view the world and my place in it.
Me too. Isaiah is just one of those prophets who really cuts to the heart of things, doesn't he? He doesn't pull any punches.
Not at all. He's all about speaking truth to power and calling people back to a right relationship with God. And in these chapters, we see that play out in a really dramatic way as he addresses the nations surrounding Judah.
Yeah, it's like he's holding up a mirror to their arrogance, their idolatry, their misplaced trust in human power. And he's saying, this is what happens when you turn away from God. This is the path to destruction.
But it's not just about judgment, right? He's also offering this incredible message of hope, this invitation to turn back to God, to experience his mercy, his forgiveness, his restoration.
Absolutely. It's like that classic prodigal son story. You know, the son who squanders his inheritance, runs off to a distant land, hits rock bottom. But then he comes to his senses, realizes his need for his father, and returns home hoping for the best.
And the father welcomes him with open arms, right? No questions asked. Just pure, unadulterated love and forgiveness.
Yeah, it's a beautiful picture of God's heart for us. He's always waiting for us to come back to him, no matter how far we've strayed, no matter how much we've messed up.
And I think that's the message that really resonates with me from these chapters of Isaiah. It's a message of both warning and hope, judgment, and mercy. It's a call to repentance, but also an assurance of God's unwavering love.
And it's a message that's so relevant for us today. You know, we live in a world where it's so easy to put our trust in the wrong things, to chase after wealth or power or success, to think that we can control our own destiny.
But Isaiah is reminding us that true security, true peace, true fulfillment can only be found in God.
It's about surrendering our will to his, trusting in his plan, even when we don't understand it, leaning on his strength when we feel weak.
You know, as we've been talking about trusting God, not nations, it's made me think about the ways we often try to find security in our own little kingdoms.
Our own little bubbles,
yeah.
Our comfort zones, our routines, our carefully constructed identities, the things that make us feel safe and in control.
But what happens when those bubbles burst? When our routines are disrupted, when our sense of security is shaken.
That's when we're forced to confront the reality that we're not actually in control.
That our little kingdoms are ultimately built on sand.
And that's where faith comes in. It's about choosing to trust in God's sovereignty, his goodness, his faithfulness, even when everything around us feels unstable and uncertain.
So it's not about retreating from the world or ignoring the challenges we face. It's about approaching those challenges with a different perspective,
yeah.
A perspective of trust and surrender.
It's about recognizing that we're not alone in this, that we have a God who is bigger than our circumstances, who is working all things together for good.
You know, one of the things that's really struck me throughout this deep dive is how Isaiah doesn't just tell us what to do. He paints these incredibly vivid pictures that really bring the message to life.
Oh, yeah. He's a master storyteller, isn't he? He uses these powerful images, these metaphors, these poetic descriptions that really stick with you.
Like that image of God's outstretched hand, both judging and delivering.
Or the description of Moab's lament, this heart-wrenching picture of their grief and despair.
It's like he's inviting us to not just understand the message intellectually, but to feel it in our bones, to let it sink down into our hearts.
And I think that's what makes Isaiah so powerful. He speaks to our emotions as well as our intellect.
And that's what we need,
mm-hmm.
right? We need a faith that's not just about head knowledge, but about heart transformation.
Absolutely. It's about letting God's truth penetrate our deepest fears, our deepest desires, our deepest longings.
It's about allowing his love to heal our brokenness, his grace to cover our shame, his power to set us free.
And that kind of transformation, that kind of freedom, that kind of hope, that's what the world needs more than anything.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Isaiah, I want to encourage you to keep wrestling with these questions, to keep seeking God, to keep trusting in his promises.
Mm-hmm. And remember, you're not alone in this journey. We're all in this together, seeking to follow God's leading and to make a difference in the world.
And as we do that, as we allow God to work in and through us, we become beacons of hope, agents of reconciliation, instruments of his love and justice.
It's a challenging calling, but it's also an incredible privilege to be part of something bigger than ourselves, to be part of God's redemptive story.
And that's a story that's still being written. It's a story that we're all invited to participate in.
So let's go out there and live it. Let's be the hands and feet of Jesus. Let's bring his love and hope to a world that desperately needs it.
That's a great way to end this conversation. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Isaiah. We hope it's challenged and encouraged you.
And we hope you'll join us again next time as we continue to explore the riches of God's word together.
Until then, grace and peace to you.